Good morning. This is Carol Ventura, Executive Director of Rhode Island Housing. This is the August 17th, 2023 in-person meeting of the Rhode Island Housing Board of Commissioners. This meeting is also available telephonically for access by the public. CJ Rotella, the Director of Information Technology for Rhode Island Housing, will provide information on this meeting.
Good morning, this is CJ Rotella. This meeting will be recorded and available for your review on Rhode Island Housing's website within 3 to 5 business days after this meeting. Except for specific Rhode Island Housing staff participating telephonically in the meeting, all callers will be muted during the meeting. To prevent any feedback or background noise, we ask telephone participants to please mute your telephones if you are not speaking. If during the meeting anyone is having technical difficulties with the audio or accessing the call, they should call 401-457-1240. Thank you.
Good morning. This is Corinne Myers, General Counsel speaking. All members of the Board of Commissioners are appearing in person this morning in keeping with the Rhode Island Open Meetings Act. Members of the public may also access the meeting via teleconference or attend in person according to their preference. If the teleconference portion is interrupted, we will stop the meeting until audio can be restored. Chairman Pryor will preside this morning and will be voting by voice vote. Meeting participants, please state your name prior to speaking each and every time for the benefit of those listening in by telephone. And again, telephone participants, if you would please mute your lines. With that, I will turn it over to Chairman Pryor to call the meeting to order. Thank you.
Thanks, Corey. Thanks, Carol. I'm pleased to bring this meeting to order. I'm Stephen Pryor, Chair of the Board, and I'm calling the meeting to order at 9:39 a.m. I'm going to ask Carol to call a roll call before we begin.
Thank you. Commissioner McAllister.
Here.
Commissioner Barry.
Here.
Commissioner Orr.
Here.
Commissioner Pryor.
Here.
Treasurer Diosa.
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you so much, Carol. So I'm going to introduce board action number one and request a motion to approve the minutes once you've had a chance to glance at them again. Feel free to glance, see if you have any amendments, and then I'll entertain the motion to approve.
I'll make a motion. It's James Diosa.
Is there a second?
Kevin Orr, I'll second.
Moved and seconded. Any discussion?
I'm going to abstain. I was not here.
There.
James Murray.
Two abstentions. Corey, would you please call the voice vote?
This is Corey Myers. Commissioners, all those in favor of approving the minutes of the Board of Commissioners meeting held on June 15th, 2023, please say aye.
Aye.
With three ayes, do we need a fourth aye, Marilena? I think so. Should we carry over until the next meeting? Yeah. We have two.
We need a
fourth, so we'll carry over till the next meeting. Thank you.
Any kind of motion to that effect, or we'll just do it? We took a vote.
Yeah. We have three ayes and the motion has to pass. So.
Yeah. Very good. Okay. This is the segment for my remarks. I'll offer brief ones, really, of gratitude once again. Today, we consider the qualified allocation plan for the state of Rhode Island, and I just want to express real praise and gratitude to the executive staff of Rhode Island Housing, led by Carol, and to the board, including Kevin and the team, regarding the revisions to this year's QAP. There was a really thorough process. We're going to hear more about it. I suspect Anne will guide us very ably once again. In reminding ourselves of the public input that was accepted and of the collaborative process within the staff and with the board. But I think really exemplary, and I just want to note that we'll probably say this several times, but among the priorities that we have manifested in the revised QAP, we are ensuring that we are prioritizing permanent supportive housing for our most vulnerable Rhode Islanders. We are ensuring that we are emphasizing the necessity of marketing vouchers and other forms of subsidy on an ongoing basis for our most vulnerable Rhode Islanders to be able to reside in the new units that we produce. And there are numerous other very useful changes. Some of them are more functional and sensible. For example, greater clarity on how the 4% allocations occur. So much more to say on it. We'll have discussion on it, but I just want to say that I think it's a representative of a very healthy process. We'll also review the budget today, and there are other important items. So there's so much work going on here at Rhode Island Housing under Carol Ventura. I just want to recognize it and conclude my remarks. So that does conclude my remarks, and I'm going to reintroduce Carol to present the Executive Director's review of recent activities and trends. So thank you, Ms. Ventura.
Thank you. Everyone's report is uploaded, but instead of going over that report this month, I've asked Leslie McKnight to provide an update on our loan servicing portfolio performance, and then after her, Amy Raynome will provide a brief update on the outcomes of the 23 GA session. Leslie?
Good morning. This is Leslie McKnight, Director of Loan Servicing. This morning I will provide a brief overview of the performance of the single-family mortgage portfolio, and the impact of COVID on the portfolio performance. So in the first couple of slides, here's a five-year review of the pre- and post-COVID trends. Implementation of the CARES Act protections beginning March of 2020, and those protections allow borrowers to defer to 18 months of mortgage payment. Borrowers only had to provide a verbal attestation to state that they were impacted by COVID. Now, this is very different than traditional loss mitigation, which requires full documentation evidencing financial hardship. These COVID protections also included suppression of negative credit reporting and suspension of late fees. With the end of the national emergency in May of 2023, borrowers can no longer request COVID forbearance protection. But borrowers who are already in forbearance have until November of this year to access forbearance. And also, you will see that impact on a continuing level of high delinquency in the 90-plus-day category. While the original COVID protections ended in May, inflation and new loss mitigation options will continue to impact our portfolio delinquency. One example is in January 2023, FHA announced the expansion of the COVID-19 Recovery Act, which was originally intended for borrowers impacted by COVID. However, that has now been expanded to all borrowers in default, regardless of reason for delinquency. And as with the original CARES Act provisions, no hardship documentation is required. In response to the impact of rising interest rates on loan modification payment affordability, FHA has also drafted another loss mitigation program, the Payment Supplement Cost of Credit. This new loss mitigation option for homeowners experiencing financial hardship will enable borrowers to keep their existing interest rates, which are currently mostly below market rates, while temporarily reducing their mortgage payment. Moving to the next slide, this graph provides a comparison of portfolio performance over a five-year period beginning 2 years prior to COVID through quarter ending in June of 2023. As you can see, the pre-COVID and COVID performance is very similar, particularly in the 30 and 60-day delinquency category. So we're basically performing similar to where we were pre-COVID, but the 90-day delinquency and the overall delinquency remain higher than pre-COVID levels as borrowers continue to exit COVID forbearance and also continue to struggle with the impact of inflation, which we will address in more detail on later slides on portfolio default. On the next slide, you will see the COVID period between March of 2020 and the end of the national emergency in May of 2022. 2,570 Rhode Island housing borrowers requested COVID forbearance. Now, all of these borrowers were delinquent. Some requested protections due to the uncertainty they felt about the financial situation. The largest number of requests were received in the initial months of COVID. 43% of all requests were received in the first 6 months of COVID, with the majority of those borrowers having FHA-insured mortgages. On the next slide, we will detail some of the COVID exit outcomes. So as borrowers ended the forbearance period, they exited COVID and we needed to identify a way to reinstate the mortgages. As far as exits, there were a number of loan mitigation options available to them depending on their ability to rebuild their pre-COVID mortgage payments. For borrowers who could afford their pre-COVID payments, both FHA and Fannie Mae created a deferred payment program which allowed the 18 months of payment forbearance to be deployed to the end of the loan. Those amounts are due and payable upon payoff, either at sale of property or refinance. For borrowers who could not afford to resume pre-COVID payments, there were several loan modification options where deferred payments were either capitalized or combined with a term extension and interest rate reduction. Or in the case of FHA-insured loans, borrowers could borrow money from their FHA, which is referred to as a partial claim, and use these funds to reinstate the loan, possibly pay down principal to achieve an affordable payment. The half funds were also used to leverage the above options for loan reinstatement, principal curtailment, and to achieve an affordable payment. The next slide provides data on completed loss mitigation. Of all the available loss mitigation options, the FHA option known as the emergency cost of claim allowed borrowers to include a pre-COVID payment of further than the loan to the end of the loan. This accounts for more than 60% of all the COVID loss mitigation exit options taken by the borrowers. The next two slides review the performance of the loan which exited COVID forbearance using one of the options reviewed in the final slide. In March of 2021, we began tracking COVID loss mitigation in the As I mentioned earlier, the COVID loss mitigation option was streamlined to allow for immediate mortgage payment relief and borrower protection, requiring only a verbal confirmation that the borrower could afford the payment, either their pre-COVID payment or the reduced payment post-COVID. As you can see from the next slide, 62.5% of borrowers who received an FHA emergency claim have agreed to default. And the default could be attributed to a lack of traditional financial documentation and review. However, borrowers have overwhelmingly cited inflation as the reason for the default. Despite the default, we are able to consider borrowers for additional loss mitigation options, including a second emergency claim or a second loan modification, depending on how much prior assistance the borrower received. The next slide shows the graduating rate of COVID defaults in March of 2021, sitting at 485 defaults in June of 2022. The final two slides provide a 16-year history of completed foreclosure and REO activity, including the recession period, COVID, and post-COVID period. The highest period of foreclosure activity was in 2011, but the impact of the Great Recession was felt from 2009 to 2014. The lowest period of foreclosure activity was during the COVID foreclosure moratorium, which began in March of 2020 and ended in December of 2021. Despite the resumption of foreclosure initiations in early 22, we have not experienced a significant increase in completed foreclosures or REO properties. Increased loss mitigation options are resulting in fewer completed foreclosures and a strong real estate market, resulting in properties that do go into foreclosure sales, selling to third parties at foreclosure for typically enough to satisfy the full debt owed. That concludes the presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Questions? This is Commissioner Ward. Just a clarification, please, Leslie. What percentage of those owners, borrowers who received COVID mitigation have redefaulted?
Well, so that's a rolling number, right? And so I actually don't have that number for you. Is that the slide that I showed is kind of a point in time on a monthly basis, how many redefaults we have. So,
right.
I can get that information.
So about, so if we're saying that 485, so that's about 20% somewhere?
It's about 20% of the 2,500, but again, that's a point in time, right? So that just looked at June of 2023. So people redefault. Some may reinstate on their own. Others need assistance with additional loss mitigation to reinstate. So it's kind of a moving number on a monthly basis.
What's your takeaway from this redefault?
So I think my takeaway is a couple of different things. I, you know, the lack of documentation. In a traditional loss mitigation, we would have the borrower file that trial modification period. So make whatever that modified payment would be over a period of 3 months to show that they have the ability to afford it. That was not required, currently is not required. The traditional loss mitigation options do not resume until October of 2024. So one may say that the lack of, you know, documentation to evidence that the borrower can afford the is one of the reasons for the high level of redefaults. But also, you know, we had COVID, we had people exiting COVID, they felt confident that they could resume payment, and then inflation hit. And the reality is that inflation really has a significant impact on our customer base. Our customers don't have a lot of reserves, and they live paycheck to paycheck, and they do the best to pay the bills, but the changes that we've seen in record inflation really did have an impact on people who may have been able to afford a reduction for a short period of time and then, you know, then struggled with inflation.
Okay. Thank you.
This is Steve. Any surprises, anything unexpected?
I don't think there were really any surprises. I think, you know, COVID really had significant, you know, impact on many people. We had a period, obviously, of unemployment. That's really not an issue right now. It's more the inflation where people are struggling. I would think, you know, one of the things that we did see is that people did take advantage of the COVID option to weren't necessarily impacted by COVID. Again, all they had to do was attest to it. So we might have had people who took advantage of it who really didn't need it, used it kind of as a security in the event that something went wrong. I think some of the options have changed behavior, right? I think people have become a little complacent. They didn't have to pay their mortgage for 18 months, and that actually changes their spending patterns. They have more money available to spend on other things, and I think we obviously saw that as on a national basis with inflation. So getting people back into a payment pattern, getting people back into looking at their budget and knowing what it's like to resume a payment of $1,500 or $2,000 that they didn't have to pay for 18 months. I think that's one of the bigger challenges, though.
Thank you.
Other questions? I have one, if I may. In your second to last slide, where you summarize historical trends on COVID, apt phrase is reduced real estate owned properties. Can you just unpack that?
Sure. So some foreclosures that we are having, we're not having that many because we have the obligation to keep people out of foreclosure. But the foreclosures that are taking place, when you have a foreclosure sale, there's an auction, the property is sold, or either we take the property back because nobody's interested in purchasing it through the competitive bid process, or it's purchased by a third party. So there are a lot of investors who are out there who are interested in purchasing these properties. They're willing to purchase them for enough to satisfy the debt or for the fair market value. Many of them are, you know, rehabilitating those properties and reselling them as well. So that's what we're seeing. So we're not taking that inventory back in like we did during, say, the period of the recession, where property values were less than the obligation, the mortgage debt that was owed. In today's market, we're seeing the value of the property far exceed the debt that's owed. So there are people who are willing to purchase those properties at auction.
Thank you. Helpful. Anyone else? All right. Carol, back to you for the second segment.
Amy.
Legislative agenda.
Amy.
Thank you, Carol. I wanted to give you a quick overview of some of the highlights of the 2023 General Assembly session. It was another big year for housing at the General Assembly. Overall, we tracked 322 bills, and one of those bills was the budget. Also, another, building on the historic investments that were made in the FY 2023 budget, the FY 2024 budget added another $71.5 million in state fiscal recovery funds for housing and homelessness programs, which brings the total investment of those funds for housing programs to $321.5 million, which is definitely the largest kind of investment we've seen in the state in housing. Of those dollars, Rhode Island Housing is administering $206.4 million. The Department of Housing is administering $110.8 million, and the Rhode Island Infrastructure Bank is administering $4.3 million. The budget also authorized a proactive housing development subsidiary of Rhode Island Housing and clarified the roles and responsibilities of the Department of Housing, providing it with 38 FTEs, and also created a $30 million state low-income housing tax credit to be administered by the Department of Housing, which will complement the federal historic tax credit, federal low-income housing tax credit. On legislation, the foreclosure mediation bill passed, which was the one bill that we were specifically requesting. It eliminated the July 1st, 2023 sunset, making that program permanent, which is very exciting. Speaker Shikarchi's housing package, I'm sure you've all heard about, of the 14 bills that were introduced as part of that package, 13 passed. Most of them go into effect January 1st. They do a broad range of things, but overall those bills change the processes for zoning, permitting to streamline those processes, streamline the comprehensive permit process, made things more density in some ways by right, really helps with some things like a transit-oriented development pilot program and a program to make it easier for adaptive reuse of commercial buildings, for residential buildings. So really a broad range of things that are going to require some changes at the local level to come into compliance with that legislation. You may recall the Rhode Island Housing is currently administering the Municipal Technical Assistance Program. We're using that program to help municipalities come into compliance. One of the things we're doing right now with a consultant from the school that was approved is to create a set of template documents that will be available to municipalities. They're all going to have to make the same sort of baseline changes. These template documents will be available to all of the municipalities to implement the changes in the law. In addition to that housing package, there was a lot of activity around landlord-tenant bills. A few highlights from those, there was legislation passed that prohibits landlords from charging an application fee. That was actually part of the speaker's package. Also, legislation was passed requiring the Secretary of Housing to create a written consumer guide of landlord-tenant laws, which will be updated biennially. There is a current landlord-tenant handbook, and it's been a very long time since it's been updated. And also, legislation was passed allowing for the sealing of residential eviction court files in residential eviction proceedings under certain conditions. All of those go into effect January 1st. Another area of focus for last session was around rent. Just a few of the highlights of those bills. One bill that was passed would require owner-occupants of pre-1978 2-3 unit properties to comply with the state web law. Previously, that group of owners were exempt. There was also legislation that passed that allows tenants to escrow their rent whenever the leased property is not in compliance with state-led housing production laws. Also, there was legislation passed that requires landlords to register certain properties, certain property identifying information on a statewide registry, and for pre-1978 properties to provide a valid certificate of conformance with the state's land law. Landlords would be prohibited from evicting tenants for non-payment if they're not in compliance with that land law. The legislation went into effect immediately, but the registry requirements don't kick in until October 1st of 2024. There was also legislation passed around creating an implementation program for the removal of lead pipes. And one last area that I'll touch on in terms of the focus of activity impacting housing, solar renewable energy. Legislation was passed that requires electric vehicle parking spaces in new and expanding parking lots for residential developments of 20 units or more. That projects that are awarded or under development prior to January 1st, 2024 are exempt, and the law is already in effect. And finally, the State Energy Conservation Code. Legislation passed requiring the State Building Code Standards Committee to revise the State Energy Conservation Code to meet the 2024 International Energy Conservation Code electric readiness provisions within a year of their release. So that's something that we'll be looking at in order to sell the construction standards as well. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Good job, Amy. I know this was, top of mind over there at the State House, a lot of long nights. So, you did a great job keeping us all updated, and pushing that hill, that ball up the hill. So thank you.
Truck.
Yeah.
Additional comments or questions? Thank you so much for that report. Lots of progress. Fantastic. All right. So we are on to the approval of external charitable donations and contributions. And I am going to turn it back to Carol.
Thank you. As the board knows, from time to time, Rhode Island Housing staff attend charitable events that are sponsored by our development partners, agencies in the community that we support. In this month, in August, the Collaborative, which is located at the Matthewson Church in downtown Providence, is having a charitable event. This organization brings several social service and actually educational programs to downtown Providence, serving individuals and families that struggle with access to treatment and mental health services and who suffer from food insecurity. So it's a great organization, and their mission aligns very closely with the work. So we're recommending approval of this event.
All right. Is there a motion?
Seconded.
Corey, would you call the roll?
Of course. This is Corey speaking. Commissioners, all those in favor of approving external charitable donations and contributions as presented, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. The motion is approved by unanimous vote.
Thank you so much. We're now taking up board action number 5. The moment has come for the approval of the final 2023 Qualified Allocation Plan, QAP. And indeed, we're going to ask Ann Berman to guide us once again on this important subject. So, Ann, to you.
Thank you. This is Ann Berman. So, as you may recall, the draft QAP was presented and approved at the July Credit Committee meeting. And then subsequent to that meeting, the QAP goes through a public comment period. So it was posted on our website. We sent an e-blast to many people, alerting them to the availability of the QAP and notifying them of a public hearing, which was held later in July to discuss the draft. So we ultimately received written comments from 3 parties and a few comments at the public meeting, all of which are outlined in the RFA. And as a result of those comments, we are recommending 3 additional changes from the many changes that were approved in July. And the first 2 were really more around language choice, so form over substance. The first is on page 26 of the modifies the language in the priority section to say individuals and families who are currently experiencing homelessness or who have experienced homelessness over the past 24 months, just to sort of clarify the true intent of the one of the priorities. The second change was in regard, as you may recall, we eliminated total development cost as an absolute in the QAP, and we just modified the language. We added some cost reasonableness language, and we just modified, you know, a high end to be upper limit, just for clarity's sake. And then the last change, which is a little bit more substantive, we do allow for developers to subtract extraordinary costs or conditions as part of our weighted average calculations under the financial leveraging. And we are making the recommendation that for projects that must go through an appeal, whether it's through SHAB or the new process through the court system, that the legal costs associated with those zoning appeals can be included as an extraordinary condition. We've seen some in the past. It can add up to real money. So those are the only 3 changes. I note that the QAP as proposed is very consistent with our underwriting guidelines, which have been approved by HUD. And they appear to be consistent with the updated NCSHA best practices, which are being updated and will be published later this year. So once The QAP actually becomes final after the board approves it and then is signed by the governor. And presuming that all happens in the next 30 days or so, we expect to issue the next RFP for low-income housing tax credits and other financing late in September. And rather than going through every one of the comments, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. I mean, I will note that at the credit committee meeting in July and then again last week, we had some robust conversations. So I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Anne. Well-run process. And again, Kevin, thanks at the credit committee. Terrific conversation, good work product, good conclusions. Kevin, do we want to possibly start with you? Would you have anything that you want to either ask or observe?
Certainly. Thank you very much,
sure.
Mr. Chairman. First of all, I'd like to thank your office for some very helpful and constructive comments and suggested changes to the QAP.
Thank you.
And secondly, I'd like to thank our development partners out there for rolling with all of these changes, because we try to keep it to a minimum every 2 years or so that they're prepared to deliver on what we're asking. So again, thank them for their flexibility. I'd just like to highlight some of the bigger changes. One, the biggest one, I think, obviously, is an increase of 19 points out of 157 and total. So it's a pretty big increase to go towards to incentivize production of units at 30% or less area median income. So I think very much in alignment with the unfortunate aggressive increase in those at the lower income levels in our state. So I think it's very responsive to current conditions. We're also looking to build that in as a component of overall mixed income housing as opposed to creating a concentration of low. So I think that's a great approach. And the other, I guess another item I'd like to highlight is our total development costs. We had a lot of conversation about that. Staying within the QAP, but moving from a threshold item to a kind of a review criteria item. So we're still keeping that, but I think opening it up for flexibility, understanding that costs have increased and the type of projects we might want to see, especially since we have all this soft money, you know, might be a little bit more expensive. So I think that's a good change as well. And that's about all I'd like to add.
Sorry. Terrific. Any responses to questions about Anne's or Kevin's comments?
Chairman, if I could add a few comments.
Please, Carol.
Reiterating exactly what you said, great work by our team, your team, and special thank you to the credit committee for being there with us all along and helping us every year with the qualified allocation plan. I feel strongly that we conducted an open and transparent process, and while, you know, we didn't accept every comment or change we received from the general public, certainly we respected all of the comments that came through the door, and I think we incorporated many of them. I believe we have balanced fair housing considerations as we put together this QAP, and I look forward to working with the housing department to ensure that we have a fair distribution of these housing resources.
Very much agreed, and to dovetail with that, I just want to recognize that in the audience today are Amy Boyle and Hannah Moore from the Housing Department. I want to thank them for their insights and input to the QAP process and in anticipation of what Carol said, the coordination around the rollout of the programs that work in accordance with the QAP. Really good work, exactly what I think we ought to do. It's a model for how we take on the most important work and first respond to the public and to the development community in particular, and then hash out comments to result in an even better product. Really great. One more chance for questions. Hearing none, we're on board action item 5, of course, which is the approval of the final QAP, and I'm going to ask for a motion.
Kevin Olman.
The chair of the relevant committee moves, and is there a second?
Second,
Ray Berry. And seconded by Maria. I am going to call the roll.
Happy to. This is Corey Meyer speaking. Commissioners, all those in favor of approving the final 2024 qualified allocation plan as presented at this meeting, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. The motion is approved by unanimous vote.
Congratulations, all. On to Board Action 6. This is the approval thresholds, program awards, and we turn it over to Elizabeth Fioto.
Thank you. This is Elizabeth Fioto. So in summary, as you know, the state of Rhode Island established thresholds in the 90s with the goal of increasing the supply of affordable housing for people with serious mental illness and or developmental disabilities. Thresholds program provides capital funding source, and we pair that with supportive services that enable the consumers with developmental disabilities or persistent mental illness to live independently. In the fiscal year 23 budget, 100,000 total was authorized for distribution under thresholds. 95,000 of that was transferred to Rhode Island Housing for distribution. We coupled that with a balance of funds that remained from previous funding rounds, and the total available to award is $551,098.22. So we have a request for proposals posted. We received two applications, and the Thresholds Program Advisory Committee met in January to review those applications and recommend the proposals that are included in Attachment A be awarded, which would total $430,000 of funds available at this time. It would create 8 new units in 2 different single-family homes and utilize 78% of the Thresholds Program funding we have available.
All right, we'll start with a motion. Is there one?
Motion to approve. This is Steve.
And
second, James Diosa.
Moved and second. Any questions or comments? Hearing none, Corey, to you.
This is Corey speaking. Commissioners, all those in favor of approval of Thresholds Program Awards as presented, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. The motion is approved. Thank you.
Board Action 7, approval of engagement of HVAC Building Automation Services Contractor in Control, and I am going to ask Guy Paroli to present the item.
Thank you. This is Guy Paroli. We're here this morning seeking approval for funds to upgrade our building management system software and some parts building management system controls, every thermostat, air conditioning unit in the 72,000 square foot complex. It was originally installed in 1995 when Slate Gar was remodeled, and then in 2004 it was added next door. So every piece of equipment that is controlled by computer software program by Schneider is under this building management system. In 2021, we were notified by our vendor in control that Schneider was phasing out the current program and that they would be looking to try to reinstall a new program, EchoStruxure. The issue with having the program be upgraded, every piece of equipment within the building may have to be upgraded. And if we were to look at every single piece here to try to switch to an alternate vendor, it may be more than just the software that needs to be upgraded. It would have to be a lot of the equipment. So when Schneider proposed this in 2021, they told us it was going to be December of 2024. The beginning of last year, they told us they moved it up to 2026, and if they were phasing out not only the software program, but a lot of the parts that we generally use to repair things aren't going to be produced anymore. So the system is proprietary to the Schneider company. Schneider will be the program that we will be using to come in. We've done research on it in my past experience and also with calling different private companies and agencies. They don't generally change their HVAC systems nor their vendors, because it could provide additional cost. So if you're upgrading something, it's going to cost X amount of dollars. If you're replacing every piece of equipment, it could lead to more cost. Currently, In Control is the vendor who has been servicing it. They've put a pretty good proposal together that you completed within 4 months from approval. They're currently servicing URI in the Department of Corrections. They have a very good track record. We feel, in looking at it, Tony and Ron and I looked at the program, that their program, which is mainly wiring and small upgrades except for software, is adequate to what we need going forward to supply the whole building. So today we're looking for the approval for $205,000 to upgrade and engage in control to such levels.
To ask for questions before we make the motion. Are there questions?
Kevin, over ahead. Please, okay, thank you. Do you anticipate that these updates will lead to improvements in energy efficiency?
Everything we try to do does have that. We were told that a lot of the newer ways that they control the HVAC systems have that built-in quality. Just as we upgraded boilers 3 years ago, we've got now continuous working boilers that provide efficiency. I mean, the way weather is, you really can't tell for a number of years. But anything that we try to put into the building has to have that little efficiency state to it. And there's very few programs out there that I feel don't do that. So anybody who's in a position to try to upgrade, especially with this type of system, would always look for that.
Guy, can you repeat for us why we need to achieve the time efficiency that sole source provides and why we couldn't do this through a more traditional bid process?
So just an RFP.
Okay.
So there are different vendors. There's Schneider, there's Andover, Johnson Controls. A lot of the equipment and a lot of the programming in the computers are proprietary to each individual vendor. If we have over 70 boxes in the whole complex in the ceilings that control. If we bring a Andover in, that box may have to be completely changed because programming might not work with that box. If you bring in the current vendor with just an upgrade to the program, then it's mainly a wiring change and maybe some other programming changes that will continue to run that. So we talk to URI and we talk to Rick, and even at URI, when they build a new building, they keep the exact same system to avoid trying to get all equipment replaced. So it's more of an update to the system, trying to minimize the potential for more costs.
Guy, forgive me. Your information is sensible and comprehensible, but I'm trying to drill in on why the sole source rather than the RFP, and you probably said it. I just didn't absorb it.
Okay.
What's the reason?
So the sole source allows us to continue within control, who has proprietary equipment and programming with this Schneider company. If we were to do the RFP and we were to choose a different company, the entire programming that they use may not interact with the existing equipment in the building. So
can I interrupt you for just a moment, just a friendly interruption? Why couldn't we craft an RFP that specifies that you need to respond with the ability to be compatible with the proprietary equipment?
I think anything can be crafted. I think it's more of history in different types of things that we've done. Certainly you can try to get somebody in here who will be at less cost. But again, in talking to some of the references that we had, when they tried to do that, they were facing more problems trying to upgrade equipment that might not be compatible.
Okay. Other questions?
No. I'll make a motion, Mr. Chairman.
Moved. Is there a second?
Second. This is Steve.
Moved and seconded. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Well, I'm sorry. I'm so accustomed to doing it, Corey. I can't get it.
It's quite all right, as long as it's apparent.
Do it?
There's no legal need to redo it. As long as it's apparent to everybody who voted in which way, we're all set.
All right.
For the record, I did not hear any opposition. Is that right? Okay. Thank you. The motion's approved.
Item 8, a big one. Approval of the fiscal year 24 operating budget, and appropriately, we are returning to Carol for the presentation.
Thank you, Chairman. Just a few comments for me, and then I will turn it over to Carol LaChapelle, our CFO, to go over the deck that she prepared for today. A few highlights, as indicated in the budget memo, we expect that we'll continue to administer ARPA funds on behalf of the state, and as a result of these resources, we expect multifamily production to be at an all-time high level, generating fee income for us and, of course, long-term interest on the loans that we're making on the multifamily deal. The resources that are available to us, these federal resources, we're able to finance housing production with volume cap, which we've never been able to do before in Rhode Island. So this is a big deal for us, and it's going to translate into hundreds of additional affordable housing as a result of being able to use that volume cap. We're solid financially with projected net revenue of over $9 million in fiscal year 24. And in addition to supporting our operations, we are proposing to continue to support several programs, including programs designed to house our most vulnerable Rhode Islanders and programs designed to increase capacity among developers in our state. So let me pause there and turn it over to Kara so she can go through.
This is Carol Ashapel. So our budget presentation includes detail on the various programs that we fund, a summary of the major components of revenue and expense, as well as a few historical graphs for reference. I'm going to focus mainly on page 5, which is the summary of revenue and expenses, and provide some context for the budget. The budget reflects continued growth, as Carol mentioned, in our loan portfolio in both our single-family homeownership loans and multifamily rental development loans, despite a challenging market with increasing interest rates. As Carol mentioned, a lot of that is due to the ARPA funds that the state has dedicated to housing. It really has assisted us and both sides with the down payment assistance program and homeownership. And the development programs that will help us on the multifamily side. Our net interest income, which is the spread on our loans or the difference between our mortgage rates and our bond costs, reflects an increase over the prior year budget as we will continue to fund our loans using bonds, some tax-exempt bonds, some taxable, depending on the market and how much volume cap that we have available. About 68% of that net interest income is related to multifamily loans, and 32% is related to single-family homeownership loans. Our fee income is budgeted higher than the prior year budget, but it is showing a significant decrease from the current year actual, and that really is related to the closeout of the rent relief program that we received fees to cover the administration of that program. And it was a costly program in terms of staffing and our partners and a call center. And so as those expenses go away, we will not be receiving fees to cover those administrative expenses. We are seeing increases in our traditional fees that Rhode Island Housing receives, specifically in our loan servicing area, an increase in those fees, and the multifamily loan origination fees as we are able to close more loans on the multifamily side. The gain on sale of loans is essentially flat year over year, and that's based on the activity in the TBA market. It has not been very efficient in the current space, so we'll continue to look for best execution. If we see improvements in the TBA market, we may sell more loans, but right now we are looking at about 80% of our loans being funded through bonds, 20% in the TBA market. As we look at the expenses, we will continue to increase our loan loss reserve to cover any delinquent loans that we have and any uninsured portion of multifamily loans. Our reserve gets reviewed by both our external auditors and the rating agencies to ensure that we are covered into the future for any losses that we may incur. We continue to fund critical housing programs, as Carol mentioned, and the detail of those programs is included in the budget package along with some explanations of what those programs are. And then the operating expenses are showing a decrease from prior year. And again, primarily that is due to the closeout of the rent relief program, less administrative expenses related to that. We will still be administering other ARPA programs, but they are less intensive in terms of expenses. Our traditional expenses include a merit increase for staff, as well as health insurance increases and, you know, inflationary increases for utilities and postage and paper and that type of those things. And that does leave us with a bottom line net revenue of 9.4, which is an increase from the prior year budget, showing our continued strength and really helping us to maintain our strong bond rating. So I'll stop there and I'll open it up for any questions you may have.
Questions? How are you at staffing levels? How we feel about that? It always seems to be a folks different one.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's moving back and forth, shifting, right? So we quickly try to expand to the extent we can use temporary help, we do that. I would say we're around, what, 230 right now?
240.
240 staff. Yeah. So I think we're adequately staffed. As we roll programs off, then, of course, here's where you are.
Yeah, so it's always around.
Always. Yeah. Always, yeah.
Other questions on the budget? Just want to note for everyone's knowledge, to the credit of Carol and the team, chairman's office, I guess, and the department are in dialogue about the budget in the exact right constructive way. We'll have more questions over time. So since there is that very good process already occurring, nothing necessary for today. Anything else?
I will turn over this call.
And well, first I'll ask for a motion. May I have a motion?
I'll make a motion.
This motion is a second.
Second, Mrs. Steve.
Moved and seconded. I'll turn it over to Corey and not conduct the vote. As is our custom, he's Corey.
This is Corey Myers speaking. All those in favor of the approval of fiscal year 2024 operating budget as presented in this meeting, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. The motion is approved by a unanimous vote.
Terrific. Action-packed agenda. We're all the way through it. I turn to Carol and make sure that there's no other item. Have we missed a thing?
Haven't missed a thing, Tim.
There has, thanks to you, a lot of business being conducted and major items we voted upon and some routine ones as well. Well done. So there being no further business, I will request a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Is there a second?
Okay.
And Corey.
This is Corey Myers. All those in favor of adjourning this meeting, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. The motion is approved, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.